This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I'm bringing you a bit of a mystery tonight. It's by Monica Woods, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And I'll be right back, give you a chance to get settled, and I'll be right back in 1 minute. So, stay tuned. And this is Ms. G. I'm back now with our story for the evening. It's by Monica Wood. It's called That One Autumn. That one autumn, when Marie got to the cabin, something looked wrong. She took in the familiar view, the clapboard bungalow she and Ernie had inherited from his father. The bushes and trees that had grown up over the years, the dock pulled in for the season. She sat in the idling car, reminded of those find-the-mistake puzzles John used to pore over as a child, intent on locating mittens on the water skier, milk bottles in the parlor. Bent in a corner somewhere over the softening page, her blue-eyed boy would search for hours, convinced that every wrong thing had been identified. More wrong things remained. Sunlight pooled in the dooryard. The day gleamed. The clean Maine air casting a sober whiteness over everything. The gravel turnaround seemed vaguely disarranged. Scanning the line of spruce that shielded the steep slope to the lake's edge, Marie looked for movement. Behind the thick mesh screen of the front porch, she could make out the wicker tops of the chairs. She turned off the ignition, trying to remember whether she'd taken time to straighten up the porch when she was last here. In early August, the weekend of Ernie's birthday, he and John had had one of their fights, and it was possible that in the ensuing clamor and silence, she had forgotten to straighten up the porch. It was possible. She got out of the car and checked around. Everything looked different after just a few weeks. The lake blacker through the part in the trees, the brown-eyed Susans gone weedy. The chairs on the porch definitely, definitely moved. Ernie had pushed a chair in frustration, she remembered, and John had responded in kind, upending the green one on his way out the door and down to the lake. They'd begun that weekend, like so many others, with such good intentions, only to discover anew how mismatched they were, parents to son. So she had straightened the chairs. She had definitely straightened them, while outside Ernie's angry footsteps crackled over the gravel, and farther away, John's body hit the water in a furious smack. She minced up the steps and pushed open the screen door, which was unlocked. "Hello," she called out fearfully. The inside door was slightly ajar. "Take the dog," Ernie had told her. "She'll be good company." She wished now she had. Though the dog, a Yorkie named Honey Girl, was a meek little thing and no good in a crisis. "I don't want company, Ernie. It's a week. It's 40 miles. I'm not leaving you." Marie was sentimental, richly so, which is why her wish to be alone after seeing John off to college had astonished them both. "But you're still weak," Ernie argued. "Look how pale you are." She packed a box of watercolors and a how-to book in her trunk as Ernie stood by, bewildered. "I haven't been alone in years," she told him. "I want to find out what it feels like." John had missed Vietnam by 6 merciful months. Then he'd chosen Berkeley, as far from his parents as he could get, and now Marie wanted to be alone. Ernie gripped her around the waist, and she took a big breath of him. Man, dog, house, yard, mill. She had known him most of her life. And from time to time, when she could bear to think about it, She wondered whether their uncommon closeness was what had made their son a stranger. "You be careful," he called after her as she drove off. The words came back to her now as she peered through the partly open door at a wedge of kitchen she barely recognized. She saw jam jars open on the counter, balled up dish towels, a box of oatmeal upended and spilling a bit of oatmeal dust, a snaggled hairbrush, a red lipstick ground to a nub. Through the adjacent window, she caught part of a rumpled sleeping bag in front of the fireplace, plus an empty glass and a couple of books. Marie felt a little breathless, but not afraid, recognizing the disorder as strictly female. She barreled in, searching the small rooms like an angry, old-fashioned mother with a hickory switch. She found the toilet filled with urine, the back hall cluttered with camping gear, and the two bedrooms largely untouched, except for a grease-stained knapsack thrown across Marie and Ernie's bed. By the time she got back up to the porch to scan the premises again, Marie had the knapsack in hand and sent it skidding across the gravel. The effort doubled her over, for Ernie was right. Her body had not recovered from the thing it had suffered. As she held her stomach, the throbbing served only to stoke her fury. Then she heard it. The sound of a person struggling up the steep, rocky path from the lake, swishing grass, a scatter of pebbles, the subtle pulse of forward motion. It was a girl. She came out of the trees into the sunlight, naked except for a towel bundled under one arm. Seeing the car, she stopped, then looked toward the cabin, where Marie uncoiled herself slowly, saying, "Who the hell are you?" The girl stood there, apparently immune to shame. A delicate ladder of ribs showed through her paper white skin. Her damp hair was fair and thin, her pubic hair equally thin and light. "Oh, crap," she said, busted. Then she cocked her head, her face filled with a defiance Marie had seen so often in her own son that it barely registered. "Cover yourself, for God's sake," Marie said. The girl did, in her own good time, arranging the towel over her shoulders and covering her small breasts. Her walk was infuriatingly casual as she moved through the dooryard, picked up the knapsack, and sauntered up the steps, past Marie and into the cabin. Marie followed her in. She smelled like the lake. "Get out before I call the police," Marie said. "Your phone doesn't work," the girl said peevishly, "and I can't say much for your toilet either." Of course, nothing worked. They turned everything off, buttoned the place up after their last visit. John and Ernie at each other's throats as they hauled the dock up the slope. Ernie too slow on his end, John too fast on his. Both of them arguing about whether or not Richard Nixon was a crook and should have resigned in disgrace. "I said, get out. This is my house." The girl pawed through the knapsack. She hauled out a pair of panties and slipped them on, then a pair of frayed jeans and a mildewy shirt that Marie could smell across the room. As she toweled her hair, it became lighter, nearly white. She leveled Marie with a look as blank and stolid as a pillar. "I said, get out," Marie snapped, jangling her car keys. "I heard you. Then do it." The girl dropped the towel on the floor, reached into the knapsack once more, extracted a comb, combed her flimsy, apparitional hair, and returned the comb. Then she pulled out a switchblade. It opened with a crisp, perfunctory snap. "Here's the deal," she said. "I get to be in charge, and you get to shut up." Marie shot out of the cabin and sprinted into the dooryard, where a bolt of pain brought her up short and windless. The girl was too quick in any case, catching Marie by the wrist before she could reclaim her breath. "Don't try anything," the girl said, her voice low and cold. "I'm unpredictable." She glanced around. "You expecting anybody?" "No," Marie said, shocked into telling the truth. "Then it's just us girls," she said, smiling a weird, thin smile that impelled Marie to reach behind her, holding the car for support. The girl presented her water-wrinkled palm, and Marie forked over the car keys. "Did you bring food?" "In the trunk." The girl held up the knife. Stay right there. Marie watched, terrified, as the girl opened the trunk and tore into a box of groceries, shoving a tomato into her mouth as she reached for some bread. A bloody trail of tomato juice sluiced down her neck. Studying the girl, her quick, panicky movements, Marie felt her fear begin to settle into a morbid curiosity. This skinny girl seemed an unlikely killer. Her tiny wrist looked breakable, and her stunning whiteness gave her the look of a child ghost. In a matter of seconds, a thin, reluctant vine of maternal compassion twined through Marie and burst into violent bloom. "When did you eat last?" Marie asked her. "None of your business," the girl said, cramming her mouth full of bread. "How old are you?" The girl finished chewing, then answered, 19. What's it to you?" "I have a son about your age." "Thrilled to know it," the girl said, handing a grocery sack to Marie. She herself hefted the box and followed Marie into the cabin, her bare feet making little animal sounds on the gravel. Once inside, she ripped into a box of Cheerios. "Do you want milk with that?" Marie asked her. All at once, the girl welled up, and she nodded, wiping her eyes with the heel of her one hand, turning her head hard right and hard left, exposing her small, translucent ears. "This isn't me," she sniffled. She lifted the knife, but did not give it over. "It's not even mine." "Whose is it?" Marie said steadily, pouring milk into a bowl. "My boyfriend's." The girl said nothing more for a few minutes until the cereal was gone. Another bowl poured, and that too devoured. She wandered over to the couch, a convertible covered with anchors that Ernie had bought to please John, who naturally never said a word about it. "Where is he, your boyfriend?" Marie asked finally. "Out getting supplies." The girl looked up quickly, a snap of the eyes revealing something Marie thought she understood. "How long's he been gone?" The girl waited. Day and a half." Marie nodded. "Maybe his car broke down. That's what I wondered." The girl flung a spindly arm in the general direction of the kitchen. "I'm sorry about the mess. My boyfriend's hardly even paper trained." "Then maybe you should think about getting another boyfriend." "I told him no sleeping on the beds. We didn't sleep on your beds." "Thank you," Marie said. "It wasn't my idea to break in here." "I'm sure it wasn't." "He's kind of hiding out, and I'm kind of with him." "I see," Marie said, scanning the room for weapons, fireplace poker, dictionary, curtain rod. She couldn't imagine using any of these things on the girl whose body appeared held together with thread. "He knocked over a gas station, two, actually, in Portland." "That sounds serious." She smiled a little. "He's a serious guy." "You could do better, don't you think?" Marie asked. "Pretty girl like you?" The girl's big eyes narrowed. "How old are you?" 38. "You look younger." "Well, I'm not," Marie said. "My name is Marie, by the way."
"I'm Tracy."
"Tell me, Tracy," Marie said. "Am I your prisoner?"
"Only until he gets back. We'll clear out after that."
"Where are you going?"
"Canada, which is where he should have gone about 6 years ago."
"A vet?" Tracy nodded. "War sucks."
"Well, now that's extremely profound."
"Don't push your luck, Marie," Tracy said. "It's been a really long week." They spent the next hour sitting on the porch, Marie thinking furiously in a chair, Tracy on the steps, the knife glinting in her fist. At one point, Tracy stepped down onto the gravel, dropped her jeans, and squatted over the spent irises, keeping Marie in her sights the whole time. Marie, who had grown up in a different era entirely, found this fiercely embarrassing. A wind came up on the lake. A pair of late loons called across the water. The only comfort Marie could manage was that the boyfriend, whom she did not wish to meet, not at all, clearly had run out for good. Tracy seemed to know this, too, chewing on her lower lip, facing the dooryard as if the hot desire of her stare could make him materialize.
"What's his name?" Marie asked.
"None of your business. We met in a chemistry class." She smirked at Marie's surprise. "Pre-med. Are you going back to school?"
Tracy threw back her head and cackled, showing two straight rows of excellent teeth. Yeah, right. He's out there right now paying our pre-registration. Marie composed herself, took some silent breaths. It's just that I find it hard to believe. People like you always do, Tracy said. She slid Marie a look. You're never willing to believe the worst of someone. Marie closed her eyes, wanting Ernie. She imagined him leaving work about now, coming through the mill gates with his lunch bucket and cap, shoulders bowed at the prospect of the empty house. She longed to be waiting there, to sit on the porch with him over a pitcher of lemonade, comparing days, which hadn't changed much over the years. Really, but always held some ordinary pleasures. Today they would have wondered about John, thought about calling him, decided against it. You married? Tracy asked, as if reading her mind. 20 years. We met in 7th grade. Then what are you doing up here alone? I don't know, Marie said. But suddenly she did. She knew exactly, looking at this girl who had parents somewhere waiting. I know what you're thinking, the girl said. You couldn't possibly. You're wondering how a nice girl like me ended up like this. When Marie didn't answer, she added, Why do you keep doing that? What? That. The girl pointed to Marie's hand, which was making absent semicircles over her stomach. You pregnant? No, Marie said, withdrawing her hand. But she had been, shockingly, for most of the summer, during John's final weeks at home. She had been pregnant. Back then, her hand had gone automatically to the womb, that strange, unpredictable vessel as she and Ernie nuzzled in bed, dazzled by their change in fortune. For nights on end, they made their murmured plans, lost in a form of drunkenness, waiting for John to skulk through the back door long past curfew, when they would rise from their nestled sheets to face him. Their first child now, not their only. His splendid blue eyes, glassy with what she hoped were the normal complications of adolescence, equal parts need and contempt. They did not tell him about the pregnancy, and by the 1st of September it was over prematurely. Marie bawled into a heap on the bed for 3 days, barely able to open her swollen eyes. Maybe it's for the best, Ernie whispered to her, petting her curled back. They could hear John ramming around in the kitchen downstairs, stocking the cupboards with miso and bean curd and other things they'd never heard of, counting off his last days in the house by changing everything in it. As Ernie kissed her sweaty head, Marie rested her hand on the freshly scoured womb that had held their second chance. It might not have been worth it, Ernie whispered, words that staggered her so thoroughly that she bolted up, mouth agape, asking, What did you say, Ernie? Did you just say something? The raising of John had, after all, been filled with fine wishes for the boy. It was not their habit to acknowledge disappointment or regret or sorrow. As the door downstairs clicked shut on them and John faded into another night with his mysterious friends, Marie turned to her husband, whom she loved. God help her more than she loved her son. Take it back, she wanted to tell him, but he mistook her pleading look entirely. She might have broken our hearts, he murmured. I can think of 100 ways. He was holding her at the time, speaking softly, almost to himself, and his hands on her felt like the meaty intrusion of some stranger who'd just broken into her bedroom. Ernie, stop there, she told him, and he did. It was only now, imprisoned on her own property by a skinny girl who belonged back in chemistry class, that Marie understood that she had come here alone to find a way to forgive him. What did he mean not worth it? Worth what? Was he speaking of John? Marie looked down over the trees into the lake. She and Ernie had been 20 years old when John was born. You think you're in love now, her sister warned, but wait till you meet your baby, implying that married love would look bleached and pale by contrast. But John was a sober, suspicious baby, vaguely intimidating, and their fascination for him became one more thing they had in common. As their child became more and more himself, a cryptogram they couldn't decipher, Ernie and Marie's bungled affections and wayward exertions revealed less of him and more of themselves. Ernie and Marie, smitten since seventh grade, it was a story they thought their baby son would grow up to tell their grandchildren. At 20, they had thought this. She wanted John to remember his childhood the way she liked to. A soft focus, greeting card recollection in which Ernie and Marie strolled hand in hand in a park somewhere with the fruit of their desire frolicking a few feet ahead. But now she doubted her own memory. John must have frolicked on occasion. Certainly he must have frolicked. But at the present moment, she could conjure only a lumbering resignation, as if he had already tired of their story before he broke free of the womb. They would have been more ready for him now, she realized. She was in a position now to love Ernie less, if that's what a child required. The shadow of the spruces arched long across the dooryard. Dusk fell. Tracy got up. I'm hungry again. You want anything? No, thanks. Tracy waited. You have to come in with me. Marie stepped through the door first, then watched as Tracy made herself a sandwich. I don't suppose it's crossed your mind that your boyfriend might not come back, Marie said. Tracy took a big bite. No, it hasn't. If I were on the run, I'd run alone, wouldn't you? Don't you think that makes sense? Chewing daintily, Tracy flattened Marie with a luminous, eerily knowing look. Are you on the run, Marie? What I'm saying is that he'll get a lot farther, a lot faster, without another person to worry about. Tracy swallowed hard. Well, what I'm saying is you don't know crap about him, or me, for that matter, so you can just shut up. I could give you a ride home. Not without your keys, you couldn't. She opened the fridge and gulped some milk from the bottle. If I wanted to go home, I would have gone home a long time ago. It had gotten dark in the cabin. Marie flicked on the kitchen light. She and Ernie left the electricity on year-round because it was more trouble not to. And occasionally they came here in winter to snowshoe through the long wooded alleys. It was on their son's behalf that they had come to such pastimes. On their son's behalf, that the cabin had filled over the years with well-thumbed guidebooks to butterflies and insects and fish and birds. But John preferred his puzzles by the fire, his long furtive vigils on the dock, leaving it to his parents to discover the world. They turned up pine cones, strips of birch bark for monogramming, once a speckled feather from a pheasant. John inspected these things indifferently, listened to his parental homilies on the world's breathtaking design, all the while maintaining the demeanor of a good-hearted homeowner suffering the encyclopedia salesman's pitch. Why don't you want to go home? Marie asked. Really, I'd like to know. She was remembering the parting scene at the airport, John uncharacteristically warm, allowing her to hug him as long as she wanted, thanking her for an all-purpose everything that she could fill in as she pleased for years to come. Ernie, his massive arms folded in front of him, wailed up, nodding madly. But as John disappeared behind the gate, Ernie clutched her hand, and she knew what he knew, that their only son, their first and only child, was not coming back. He would finish school, find a job in California, call them twice a year. My father's a self-righteous blowhard, if you're dying to know, Tracy said, and my mother's a doormat. Maybe they did the best they could. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they tried in ways you can't know about. Tracy looked Marie over. My mother's 42, she said. She would have crawled under her chair the second she saw the knife. Marie covered the mustard jar and returned it to the fridge. It's possible, Tracy, that your parents never found the key to you. Tracy seemed to like this interpretation of her terrible choices. Her shoulders softened some. So where's this son of yours, anyway? We just sent him off to Berkeley. Tracy smirked a little.
Uh-oh.
What's that supposed to mean? Marie asked. What do you mean? Berkeley's a pretty swinging place. You don't send sweet little boys there.
I never said he was a sweet little boy, Marie said, surprising herself. But it was true. Her child had never been a sweet little boy.
You'll be lucky if he comes back with his brain still working.
I'll be lucky if he comes back at all.
Tracy frowned. You're messing with my head, right? Poor tortured mother. You probably don't even have kids. She folded her arms. But if you do have a kid and he's at Berkeley, prepare yourself.
Look, Tracy, Marie said irritably, why don't you just take my car? If you're so devoted to this boyfriend of yours, why not go after him?
Because I have no idea where to look, and you'd run to the nearest police station. Tracy finished the sandwich and rinsed the plate, leading Marie to suspect that someone had at least taught her to clean up after herself. The worst parent in the world can at least do that. John had lovely manners, and she suddenly got a comforting vision of him placing his scraped plate in a cafeteria sink.
The nearest police station is 20 miles from here, Marie said.
Well, that's good news, Marie, because look who's back.
Creeping into the driveway, one headlight out, was a low-slung, mud-colored Valiant with a cracked windshield. The driver skulked behind the wheel, blurry as an ink blot. When Tracy raced out to greet him, the driver opened the door and emerged as a jittery shadow. The shadow flung itself toward the cabin as Marie fled for the back door and banged on the lock with her fists. In moments he was upon her, a wiry man with a powerful odor and vice-like hands. He half-carried her back to the kitchen as she fell limp with panic. Then, like a ham actor in a silent movie, he lashed her to a kitchen chair with cords of filthy rawhide.
You want to tell me what the hell we get rid of her?
He snarled at Tracy, whose apparent fright gave full flower to Marie's budding terror. That he was handsome, dark-eyed, square-jawed, with full shapely lips made him all the more terrifying.
What was I supposed to do? Tracy quavered.
Listen, I kept her here for a whole day with no...
Where's your keys? He roared at Marie.
Here, they're here, Tracy said, fumbling them out of her pocket.
Let's go, Mike, please, let's just go.
You got money? He asked, leaning over Marie, one cool strand of his long hair ricking across her bare arm. She could hardly breathe, looking into his alarming, moist eyes.
My purse, she gasped, in the car.
He stalked out, his dirty jeans sagging at the seat into which someone had sewn a facsimile of the American flag. He looked near starving, his upper arm shaped like bedposts, thin and tapered and hard. She heard the car door open and the contents of her purse spilling over the gravel.
The pre-med was a lie, Tracy said. I met him at a concert.
She darted a look outside, her lip quavering. You know how much power I have over my own life, Marie? She lifted her hand and squeezed her thumb and index finger together. This much.
He was in again, tearing into the fridge, cramming food into his mouth. The food seemed to calm him some.
He looked around. He could have been 25 or 45, a man weighted by bad luck and a mean spirit that encased his true age like barnacles on a boat.
Pick up our stuff, he said to Tracy. We're out of this dump.
Tracy did as he said, gathering the sleeping bag and stuffing it into a sack. He watched her body damply as she moved. Marie felt an engulfing nausea but could not move herself, not even to cover her mouth at the approaching bile. Her legs were lashed to the chair legs, her arms tied behind her, giving her a deeply discomforting sensation of being bound to empty space. She felt desperate to close her legs, cross her arms over her breast, unwilling to die with her most womanly parts exposed.
I'm going to be sick, she gulped, but it was too late. A thin trail of spit and bile lolloping down her shirt front.
Mike lifted his forearm, dirty with tattoos, and chopped it down across Marie's jaw. She thumped backward to the floor, chair and all, tasting blood, seeing stars, letting out a squawk of despair. Then she fell silent, looked at the upended room, stunned. She heard the flick of a switchblade and felt the heat of his shadow. She tried to snap her eyes shut to wait for what came next, but they opened again, fixed on his,
In the still, shining irises, she searched for a sign of latent goodness or regret, some long-ago time that defined him. In the sepulchral silence, she locked eyes with him, sorrow to sorrow. He dropped the knife. "Ah, screw it, you do that," he said to Tracy, then swaggered out. She heard her car revving in the dooryard, the radio blaring on. Now her eyes closed. A small rustle materialized near her left ear. It was Tracy, crouching next to her, holding the opened blade. "Shh," Tracy said. "He's a coward, and he doesn't like blood, but he's not above beating the hell out of me." She patted Marie's cheek. "So let's just pretend I've killed you." Marie began to weep, silently, a sheen of moisture beating her beneath her eyes. She made a prayer to the Virgin Mary, something she had not done since she was a child. She summoned an image of Ernie sitting on the porch, missing her, of John scraping that plate in the college cafeteria with shocking tenderness. Tracy made a small cut near Marie's temple, just above the hairline. It hurt very little, but the blood began to course into her hair in warm, oozy tracks. Tracy lifted the knife, now a rich, dripping red. "You'll be okay," she said. "But head wounds bleed like crazy." The horn from Marie's car sounded in two long, insistent blasts. "You chose a hell of a life for yourself, Tracy," Marie whispered. "Yeah," Tracy said, closing her palm lightly over the knife. She got up. "But at least I chose." "You don't know anything about me." "Ditto. Take care." For much of the long evening, Marie kept still, blinking into the approaching dark. She had to pee desperately, but determined to hold it even if it killed her, which she generally thought it might. She was facing the ceiling, still tied, the blood on her face and hair drying uncomfortably. She recalled John's childhood habit of hanging sloth-like from banisters or chair backs, loving the upside-down world. Perhaps his parents were easier to understand this way. She saw now what had so compelled him. The ceiling would make a marvelous floor, a creamy expanse you could navigate however you wished. You could fling yourself from corner to corner, unencumbered except for an occasional light fixture. Even the walls looked inviting. The windows appeared to open from the top down. The tops of doors made odd, amusing steps into the next room. Framed pictures floated knee-high, the reverse images full of whimsy hard to decode. In time, she got used to the overturned room, even preferred it. It calmed her. She no longer felt sick. She understood that Ernie was on his way here, of course. He was. He would be there before the moon rose. Missing her, full of apology for disturbing her peace. But he needed her. The house was empty and their son was gone, and he needed her as he steered down the dirt road, veering left past the big boulder, entering the dooryard to find a strange, battered car in a terrifying silence. "Oh, Ernie," she said when he did indeed panic through the door. "Ernie, sweetheart, untie me." And he came, just as she knew he would. And then they no longer looked back on this season as the autumn when they lost their second child. This season, with its gentle temperatures and propensity for inspiring flight, they recalled instead as that one autumn when those awful people, that terrible pair, broke into the cabin. They exchanged one memory for the other, remembering Ernie's raging man-sized sobs as he worked at the stiff rawhide, remembering him rocking her under a shaft of moonlight that sliced through the door he left open. Remembering, half laughing, that the first thing Marie wanted to do after being rescued by her prince was pee. This moment became the turning point, this moment and no other, when two long married people decided to stay married, to succumb to the shape of the rest of their life, to live with things they would not speak of. They shouldered each other into the coming years because there was no other face each could bear to look at in this moment of turning. No other arms they could bear but each other's, and they made themselves right again. They did. Just the two of them. That was That One Autumn by Monica Wood. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hope you enjoyed that. Until next time, good night.